welcome back to Shattering Myths. Before we turn to the prophecy, I do want to turn back to this moronic statement by President Obama. The reality is that Christians do not like what Yahusha said, and so they very seldom quote him. They certainly don't live by what he had to say, because what he had to say is overtly opposed to their religion. They prefer Paul instead. So it doesn't apply to Christians. It doesn't apply to Jews, particularly religious Jews, who deny the very status of the individual who made the statement. It certainly doesn't apply to Muslims, because they didn't accept a single thing that Yahusha said. And it doesn't apply to Hindus and Sikhs either. Moreover, the statement, love our neighbor as we love ourselves, is the second half of the statement. The first half of the statement is vastly more important. This is a consequence, really, of the first half of the statement. The first half of the statement is with all of our mind, all of our heart, all of our capability that we love Yahweh, our God. And as a result of that, we love our children, our neighbors as ourselves. It's amazing just how stunningly corrupt, how twisted politicians are, and there is no less twisted politician on the planet today than Barack Hussein Obama. Hello, Glenn. Welcome.
Hello, I just woke up, started listening myself here. I've been working quite a lot, so I haven't been around parts of the program. But the first thing I heard you talk about was this quote, and I thought to myself, oh, yeah, I've been down this road before and seen presentations about this. Show me anywhere in the Quran or the Hadith where there is any such thing as a mandate to love. The Quran doesn't speak of love. You might see the word love crop up in some sense of like, Allah loves this or Allah loves that.
Or
Allah hates this or Allah hates that, but there's no mandate to love humanity or anything like that in Islam.
That is correct. Islam, the call in Islam is for Muslims to fight and kill on behalf of Muhammad, and the first two-thirds of the Quran is a hateful argument between Muhammad and his neighbors. So two-thirds of the Quran, maybe three-quarters of the Quran, if you were to reorder it chronologically, is a never-ending tit-for-tat argument showing how Muhammad hated his neighbors and Muhammad's neighbors hated him and his God hating upon Muhammad's neighbors. Now, when we've had IQ on, IQ and I have a disagreement on this, and I'm going to side here with IQ over my position. I thought that there were two places in the Quran that the Arabic word for love was used, and in both cases it spoke of Allah loving those who fight and die in his cause. IQ says the word for love doesn't appear in the Quran, but you would be absolutely correct that there is absolutely no mandate, no instruction, no inference of any kind in the Quran for Muslims to love their neighbors. They are told to fight and kill their neighbors. In fact, one place in the Quran, it actually talks about that if Muslims purport to be peaceful, if a Muslim chooses peace over jihad, that you are ordered as a jihadist Muslim to savage, to ravage, to terrorize your hypocritical neighbors so that they not only can no longer exist, but that it would be a warning of anyone else to accept a peaceful attitude as a Muslim.
Right. And like conversely, you know relative to Yahweh and Yahusha. I'm not quite sure where you stand on the first epistle of John or Yohanan, but there's a three-word sentence in there. It says, Theos estin agape, which would be God is love, agape love, the Greek. And also we also have Theos estin phanuma, or God is spirit. That's very different than
Islam. My view on the books that are attributed to the three letters that are attributed to Yohanan is that I think we have every reason to consider that the eyewitness account scribed by Yao Kanin is legitimate, and that it was written by the man who served as not only one of the 12 disciples, but was specifically called the disciple whom Yahusha loved, and the man whom who he revealed his revelation to, which means he would be the individual that Yahweh trusted the most in terms of conveying an accurate message. So I think that the book of eyewitness accounts that is attributed to him was written by him. And I don't think there's any question that Yahweh Kanin received the revelations that bear the name revelation in the revelation to Yahweh Kanin. Whether or not the three letters are that are attributed to him were written by him, we really don't know. So I have no way of knowing whether or not it's true. As of love, so let's speak a moment, because I think this is really interesting. There's this Christian notion that God is just love. He's just so love.
Nothing but love.
Yahweh is infinite in love. That is true. It says his capacity to be merciful and loving is without end. Now, that does not mean that you can define God as love. And that is because a comprehensive understanding of love, particularly in an environment where there is the ability to do harm, to be evil, to corrupt, is that love must hate to be loving.
Right. There are statements of the things that God hates, and true love, must hate evil.
That's correct. Yeah, it's got to protect
evil.
Right,
yeah.
To protect one's children. From harm, one must be opposed to those influences which are harmful. So it's it is one of those statements that you really have to be very careful.
I was gonna lock horns with you a little bit on the love issue a little bit because I understand the wishy-washy marshmallowy definition of love, like the liberal weak mind, weak chinned definition of love we see. That's definitely not that. I don't know anybody who would concur
That. Yeah, there's this notion that God's going to forgive everybody and want everybody in heaven because he loves all the little children. And that view of God is completely incongruous with the not only with Yahweh, which they know, but it's incongruous with Yahusha, who was vicious in his attack on the religious and political establishment of the day. So we have to be really careful.
Not that low testosterone, left liberal, wishy-washy liberal pastors, kind of love.
Their kind of love is the coexist bumper sticker, which is we're going to be completely ignorant, and what we're going to say is that our view of love is that it is tolerant of all things, even when the things that we are tolerating are vehemently opposed to one another. It's pure hypocrisy. It's irrational. If you genuinely love someone, you are going to be zealous and jealous to protect them.
Right.
And that's the nature of true love. I want to make a valid attempt to go through the 18th chapter of Yashaya. And as I do at this time, and please stay with us, Glenn, I want to provide a possibility of a different perspective. The 18th chapter of Yashaya obviously follows the 17th, and there were no chapters when Yashaya was revealed to the prophet by Yahweh. And so, in our normal view of things, we would say that one thing follows another. So this warning, this condemnation of America, follows the Magog War, where Israel is inundated with Islamic jihadists, and God blows them away, and then he vents his frustration with his animosity towards America. And that would be in the chronology of things. But there's a very real possibility that Yashaya 17 and Yashaya 18 are reporting parallel events from a different perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And that, therefore, Yahweh's condemnation of the United States is because of the role that we played in the Syrian civil war, which is how the 17th chapter begins, in the destruction of Damascus and of that country, and how that led to the dismemberment of Israel and thinning it of the waste, all of which the United States is complicit. You know, the American invasion of Iraq is what started this in motion. The fact that that Muslims now outgun Israel 25-1 is a direct result of the United States equipping them to do so. And so I think there is a possibility that Yahshua 18 parallels Yahshua 17 and speaks of the same events from a different perspective. And so with that in mind, the possibility of that mind, it could be describing the same harvest, the same war, and in that case, the same stand that Yahweh was taking on behalf of his people. So let's listen to this. Woe, expressing dissatisfaction and a warning to the land of whirling and buzzing wings, which is from the region beyond, situated on the opposite side of the direction of the rivers of Cush, which is either the Nile Delta or northern Mesopotamia, probably both. It dispatches envoys by way of the sea, and so in floating vessels on the surface of the waters, the messengers travel swiftly, indulgently, and immorally, without any regard for the consequence of their mission. This nation of people from different races and places is tall, often intoxicated, immodest, and they have a propensity to take things away from others, particularly their land. They are scrubbed clean, smooth-skinned, and completely shaven, and typically reckless. These people are feared for causing distress through intimidation and awesomely dreadful acts, but they are also respected by some for their achievements and their capabilities. From here to there and beyond, in a future time, before we go on, you laughed at something that was humorous in a way when it talks about America taking land away from others. That's how America.
That seems like a pretty apt descriptor. I mean, we specialize in that.
That's one of the things that America has been best or worst at, depending on your perspective. I mean, it took the land away from the native peoples, killing them, warring with them for over 200 years. It then took land away from the Spanish, took land away from the Mexicans. We took land away from the Russians, and it just goes on and on and on. I remember we're considering the testimony that is presented against America in the 18th chapter of Yahshua. It says, this population, which is comprised of many different races, routinely vomits up and spews out nonsense in a strange foreign language, talking down to others, mocking them, while continually marching off to war, based on this condescending and moronic rhetoric, always trying to impose its influence, establishing the rules while eagerly expecting to throw inhabitants out of their land. It aggressively subdues others, trampling them down. This is a country divided by rivers. And all who inhabit the earth, and I know it's just hard to read that and just not laugh. God's got a sense of humor. Boy, does he ever nail this country. All of those who inhabit the earth and also those who dwell in the land, when the sign on the upright pole is lifted up to demonstrate my purpose on my mountain, you will all actually see, gaining a perspective to genuinely understand. And also when the shofar ram's horn sounds at this specific time to convey this plan, you will all listen, paying attention. So there is the possibility, Glenn, that this sign that is lifted up, this ram's horn that is blown, is a direct result of the Spirit intervening in the midst of the Magog War, which Yahshua 17 speaks of this flood of Muslim jihadists, terrorists into the Promised Land, and God blowing them away. And
right.
When he blows them away, he's not going to just have his spirit blow them away. He's going to leave a marker of it was me. He's going to sound the trumpet and leave a marker on and going to say it was me who did this, and this is why I did it.
Well, I think of the blowing of a horn makes a sound. Sound is vibration. I just think about vibrations, and you're also talking about megaseismos and country divided by rivers, and the river that divides the country right down the middle is one of the largest, seismic fault zones that there is. And if that, one in the middle of the country near the Mississippi and stuff, I hear the New Madrid fault goes, I can almost picture, things like that we have. I can almost picture that sort of thing being a natural disaster type judgment, or it could be man-made weapons of war. But you were still describing the country and them babbling and saying things and being arrogant and stuff. A couple terms popped right to mind. Manifest destiny and American exceptionalism. American exceptionalism. Yeah.
Remember Vladimir Putin's letter to the American people that was published in the New York Times, where he took exception with Obama's declaration of American exceptionalism as it relates to America wanting to bomb the Syrian capital. And Obama claimed that we had the right to do so because America was exceptional. And Putin just absolutely took him to task, and one of the most brilliant letters any politician has written in the modern era, in that New York Times piece. And yes, American exceptionalism and manifest destiny is the living embodiment of what God despises about this country.
Yeah, it translates quite easily as hypocritical arrogance.
Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly. And it's. I think when I counted the number of adjectives that are being used to describe America, I think there's a little over 30 of them. And they were all chosen with precision, and we're the living embodiment of every one of them. And most of them are negative.
And I've heard for years people say, where's America in prophecy? Where's America in prophecy? Why don't we see more of America in the Bible? It's like, wow, I guess we weren't paying attention.
We weren't paying attention. And part of that, by the way, is the fact that Christians believe themselves to be exceptional, American Christians. And they think that America is going to play this grand role of ushering in a new Jerusalem, if you will, I guess, in Washington. And that Americans are going to play this huge role in the rapture. And we're going to be soldiers, the onward Christian soldiers fighting for the Lord. And so Christians view themselves in that role. So they can't imagine that America wouldn't play this huge role in end times prophecy. And yet America does. It's just that it's being condemned.
Right. Exactly.
So they missed it.
It's not uncommon to hear American Christian missionaries take the opposite side and talk about how apostate and reprobate America has become, and how it's not America that's preaching the gospel or whatever, in their terms.
Yeah.
But
of course.
Yeah, we're a mess.
Yeah, we have been warned. I mean, woe is a warning. So God is telling us that. In fact, He even said that this was a land a great deal of distance away from Israel, and in a distant time that He was describing. He couldn't have been more clear in terms of naming this place that we call the United States of America. We'll be back in a minute. Welcome back to Shattering News. After Yahweh has declared that He is condemning, exposing, condemning, warning the United States of America, and then tells us that He is establishing His standard, which is obviously in opposition to that which is proclaimed by the United States on His mountain. He then says that He is going to spend the next bit of time, and I think it's the last 3.5 years of the tribulation, in heaven, in a better place. Everything that I read in Daniel about the nature of the beast, the transgressor, to use the terms that Gabriel, the arch messenger, provided, that he's going to be able to run amok with the earth during this period of time, and that Yahweh is going to spend this time with his family. because of the harvest which has already transpired. He says, indeed, because here and now, at this point in time, says Yahweh, as for me, I will be silent and at peace, removed from the tribulation in a better place. Which is to say, all of the foibles being endured by man, the wars, the earthquakes, the tsunamis, the asteroid strikes, all of these things are just part of the flow of natural events, or their man harming other men. God's not going to be responsible for them. He is going to leave the earth to the consequence of its behavior. Then I will look, choosing to always be observant, anticipating my desire, unending and caring response, where I and heaven will benefit. In my dwelling place, from the well-known location where space and the universe was established, and which is the basis for the foundation of life, and in the manner of radiant and glowing, warm and passionate light, akin to an enveloping cloud of encompassing dew in the warmth and enthusiasm of the harvest. God has painted a picture of what he's going to be like in heaven. Indeed, before the approaching presence of the harvest, as the budding blossoms form and become perfect, and then as the hardened and unfit fruit, it will be dealt with for becoming clusters for wild birds of prey, glistening eagles, falcons, and hawks. And then the insignificant and the worthless who squander and trivialize, they will be stopped. They're going to be taken down. They will be banished. They'll be snuffed out with a sharp implement. So here God is now talking about the time of the approaching harvest, just as he did in the statement in the 17th chapter. Now, this could be either one of two harvests, depending if these events are parallel events or sequential events. He's either talking about the harvest that will occur on Yom Kippurim when he returns and the remainder of Yisrael and Yehudah is reconciled unto him. Or he's speaking of the perfection of his children, then these could be the children that exist as Goyim, who have been adopted into the covenant, and the children of who are descendants of Jacob, who are also now part of the covenant. And their overall foibles, their challenges that they are enduring with the hardened and unfit fruit that needs to be dealt with. So it could be either, to be in parallel or to be sequential in time. As for the wild birds of prey, the glistening eagles, falcons, and hawks, I know a nation that deploys many thousands of them. They're part of our Air Force. They're part of our Navy. They're part of our Army. And the insignificant and worthless who squander and trivialize, which would be speaking particularly of the United States, but also of the Muslims combatants, they're going to be stopped, they'll be taken down, they'll be vanished, be snuffed out, as if with a sharp implement. So then, with regard to the forsaken castaways, they will be completely rejected and totally removed, cut off and separated. Again, if this is in parallel, he's speaking of Muslims. If it's sequential, he's talking about Americans. And they shall, and by the way, there's not a huge distinction between them. That's not to say the majority of Americans are Muslims. They're not. It is to say that the weapons that are being snuffed out, the vehicles that are being rejected and blown away, are American, that are transporting these Muslims into Israel. Without American weapons, this force would not have been unstoppable. They shall actually and continuously be abandoned and forsaken altogether, completely, and all at once, for the birds of prey in high places and for the beasts of the realm. God is telling us that those who he confronts, particularly during the tribulation, are going to be eternally separated from him. They're going to be find themselves tormented in Sheol. And that is because at this point, after God has raised his standard, after he has acknowledged the choice, this election that we're all given the opportunity to choose, him or man, that at that point, anyone that has not chosen to engage in the covenant and to rely on Yahweh will be considered in opposition to him. And so at this point, there will only be the choice of heaven or hell. And so what he's describing now is hell. It's eternal abandonment. This is Sheol. And they will be abruptly awakened in the summer with vexing and exasperating action taking against them. All kinds of birds of prey and all manner of beasts of the realm will be among, upon, and against them during the autumn and the winter, continually ridiculing and taunting them for actually being irrational and consistently confused. You see, they're going to die, but they aren't going to stay that way. They're going to be awakened, and it's going to be a rude awakening because they will awake in Sheol. They will find the summer vexing and exasperating. And all kinds of birds of prey, these are flying creatures which hunt and kill the dead, prey upon the dead. And also all manner of beasts, this is always equated with Satan, in the realm will be among them, against them, during the autumn and winter as well, year-round, continually ridiculing and taunting them for actually being irrational and consistently confused. You know, the people that, whether or not they conspired with Satan or not, you know, we don't really know if a meaningful number of politicians and generals and international bankers and religious clerics know that they are conspiring with Satan or they're just unconsciously doing his bidding. It says that the very spirits that they have served are going to be mocking them, saying, you know, you were once high and mighty. Look where you are now. You once thought that you were the gateway to God, the gateway to salvation, and look at you down here now. You'll be mocking them. It is the just reward for those who put themselves on a pedestal and claim to be far more than they are. In this last statement, we had Kutz, and Kutz was translated, they will be abruptly awakened in the summer with vexing and exasperating action taking against them. It was written in the Call Perfect, consecutive. And that reveals that those who have died in open hostility to Yisrael will be abruptly awakened to a totally new and eternal reality. They will wish that they could have remained dead, because the perpetually damned will find themselves loathed by those who beguiled them, those who now will vex them, annoy them, and aggravate them to the point of total exasperation. Also, while there's a hint of hot in this term, it is addressing the vehement attitude displayed by Satan's little helpers, the demons, not the temperatures associated with Sheol. But it also speaks of the time of year when spring turns to summer. And since Chiroth addresses the period of autumn leading to winter, we know that this torment will be year-round without intermission. But perhaps the most telling indication of all is found in the consecutive mood ascribed to Kutz, because it reveals that these living dead will be in this horrible situation because of the choices they made during their lives. God's hellish depiction of the realm of the forsaken and damned was advanced through Chiroth, which conveys that inmates of Sheol will endure a fall and winter of their discontent. Sounds like the title of a novel. They will be Chiroth, taunted and ridiculed, something political and religious elitists will find particularly excruciating. Scorned and vilified for their pathetic attempts to thwart God's people, God's place, God's purpose, the once proud and powerful will now be mocked and insulted for the confused and irrational rhetoric they spewed at the unsuspecting. They are being held accountable for the millions, if not billions, of lives they shortchanged. Further, scribed in the Call Imperfect, while they did not choose this fate, they are actually going to have to endure it for an eternity because of the irrational decisions these living dead made during their rise to power. I'd be remiss if I didn't share the fact that now that I have spent the last few weeks translating Daniel 7 and 8, that God goes into great detail, speaking of the provocation that will be committed by the Torahless one, by the transgressor, by the beast during the last days. And what he says routinely is that he will prey upon the world's political, military, and economic users, leaders. That he's going to use them, that he's going to succeed initially through promising, feigning economic prosperity through an economic angle. And then the very people that he used to climb to power, he's going to undermine. He's going to humiliate them. And so we ought to be aware that what is being described here in Yeshaya 18 is an absolute sync with what Yahweh is describing to the prophet Daniel 150 years later, almost 200 years later, some 750 BCE to 550 BCE. It is also interesting, a tantalizing little detail, that when we examine Daniel 7 and 8, we know exactly from which country this bad boy is going to emerge. Now, what's interesting is after Yahweh has explained the fate of those who he is antagonized by, who are in opposition to him, he says, at this time, she shall direct and guide him, delivering him as a gift which is agreeable, one born out of reverence and respect, to approach Yahweh of the vast array of spiritual implements. The people that Yahweh is bringing home would be his covenant children. And he's saying that his set-apart spirit is going to facilitate this and is going to guide and direct. Now, him, in all likelihood, speaks of the same him that we found in the midst of the 17th chapter of Yeshaya, which is Jacob, the descendants of Jacob, which is also Yisrael, which is the covenant, delivering the covenant's children to Yahweh, the ultimate gift and the agreeable gift, born out of reverence and respect, all so that we can approach Yahweh. And God is removing these people from the world, and particularly, I think, since we're just talking about it, from America. He says, then people who have become family, who were arrogant but are now altered and willing to follow, and who were perverse but now have been scrubbed clean, will come out of a nation feared from here to there and beyond in this future time. A population which is comprised of many different races from different places with strange and foreign language talking down to others while continually marching off to war on their condescending rhetoric, always trying to impose influence and establish the rules, eagerly throwing inhabitants out of their land, aggressively subduing others. A nation whose country is divided by rivers, brought to the place of the name of Yahweh, of the vast array of spiritual implements, Mount Zion, to the signpost on the way. Yes, Glenn.
In that very description, if you think about the description of this people, and Americans, the American culture and races largely came out of Europe, and even things such as like short hair and shaven faces and stuff like that came out of of Europe. If this were read during the times of the Roman Empire, they would say, hey, you're talking about those Europeans, or in the time of the Reformation, Enlightenment, hey, this is the Europeans. But then it came over to America. It's almost, I'm wondering if it could be inclusive of more than just America, but the taking of the land thing is very American, especially on the rivers.
Yes.
I'm in a city that's founded on, you're just looking at the rivers, my city's founded by the Delaware and the Schuylkill, the East and the Hudson, the Mississippi, the Missouri, the Columbia, you name it. This country is almost defined, you know, by its rivers.
Yes, also defined by its naval prowess. There are 13 aircraft carrier battle groups. It's clearly that he's talking about the United States, but he's saying that he's taking his children out of the United States.
Right.
So the United States is a hostile foe here that he's harvesting his children from. He's gathering his children in from this horrible foe and bringing them to the signpost along the way. Remember, he talked about how he's going to establish his sign on the upright pole. Well, now he's talking about the place where that sign exists, which is Mount Zion, which means the signpost.
I'm not sure. Exodus.
A mini Exodus, out of what is the United States. And so this is a frightening prophetic testimony on if you happen to be an American. And, you know, I don't know if these events are in parallel. If they're sequential. I think there's an argument that can be made either way, but it doesn't change the fact that God is very adverse to the nation that wants you to stand and sing God Bless America.
Absolutely. If I may, a couple things I wanted to hit and then get out of the way and let you hit the answer. First of all, just a brief aside, the winner of our discontent was Shakespeare before it was Steinbeck. But
okay, there you go.
In a novel.
Yes, that's, I'm just and the term was actually conceived first by Iowa circa 750 BCE.
Right.
Probably predates Shakespeare by a day or two. By the way, you know what's interesting about Shakespeare is that well, there is a possibility with Sir Francis Bacon, and I don't know that for certain whether it was, but since Sir Francis Bacon played a huge role in the King James translation, much of Shakespeare's best lines are actually paraphrases of something that is found in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms. Glenn, we'll have to save that last thought to tomorrow's program. Please join us. And between now and then, may Yah bless you all.